This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, and welcome to WGTD's Education Matters. I'm your host this week, Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And I'm very excited to tell you who my guest is today, because it's Alan Anderson, a personal friend and a wonderful meditation teacher. He's a music educator, professional musician, and a writer. He's been a student of meditation and mindfulness for over 30 years. And for the past few years, Alan has worked through three Milwaukee foundations, teaching mindfulness and self-regulation skills to public school children. He's also the originator of AMAP, Arts and Mindfulness for Academic Progress, and has done professional development seminars in business and education. In addition, he was the co-founder of Windhorse Retreat Center in Plymouth, Wisconsin, which he still facilitates. Prior to teaching, he was a professional jazz musician for 20 years and also toured, performed, and recorded with Paul Sebar, playing American roots music, R&B, funk, soul, jazz, Latin music, your basic New Orleans musical gumbo. So that's Alan Kent Anderson. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Thanks for arranging this.
Sure. Thanks for coming. And I didn't mention, but do want to mention right off the bat, too, that you're the author of an award-winning book that's really been hot in many circles. It's called When Bad Lands, How Not to Numb Out, Freak Out, or Bottom Out, Buddhist Style. There's a foreword by Fleet Mall. And I've read it a couple of times, and I think it's a wonderful book. So hopefully we can talk about that as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sure. So where to begin? You know, I think a basic definition of mindfulness as you understand it would be really helpful. So when you define mindfulness, how do you do it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, almost somewhat loaded at this time with the proliferation of mindfulness in the public sphere. I learned mindfulness as a part of a two-part approach to meditation. And so it was called mindfulness awareness. It was also called shamatha vipassana, which was the Sanskrit word. And the mindfulness part is the basis for it. And the mindfulness is just bringing your mind and placing it on some object of meditation. That's how it's done in the meditation tradition. So you may have heard of people, they might be focusing on the breath, so they're mindful of the breathing process. They might be looking at a candle, and that's what the mindfulness process is. Your attention is placed, you're mindful of that object. Mm. And then when your mind shifts from that, which it will do immediately and many, many, many times, then you bring it back. And so the mindfulness practice is placing your attention on the object and then bring it back when you get distracted. Mm. But that's only one part. The second part is awareness in the traditions I've learned. So the awareness part is what you discover from your mindfulness practice. So you're doing this practice, keeping your mind on your breath, let's say, for an example, and you would get distracted. And the more you do this, you discover there's a pattern, perhaps, to those distractions. Hmm. Things get distracted often the same way, the same storylines you start telling yourself, and you no longer are thinking about the breath. So mindfulness is simply placing your mind on the object, coming back. But there's a much richer tradition than that. I feel like many people just teach that part as if that's that's all there is to do with this tradition, this amazing tradition of meditation. So, I mean, you know, a dog can be mindful, right? You know, hold the bone in front and they'll look at it. So the awareness part is the other half of it. But I think people use the word mindfulness as sort of shorthand for the whole collection of mindfulness and awareness.
I see. Yeah, that's very helpful. And you come out of a Buddhist tradition specifically. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
With regard to mindfulness?
Yeah. How does it connect to your understanding of mindfulness? At some point fairly soon, I'd like to get to how you teach it both within, say, a Buddhist center and then in a school setting.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So my first introduction to mindfulness was, I think, in the first yoga classes I ever took. But in the Buddhist tradition, I learned it in the way I just explained it to you. We did not focus on a candle or a light or anything like that, or a sound, which some people use. Again, whatever you can put your mind, focus it and aim it towards. But I learned it with breath. Mm. And so in our tradition, we would connect somehow with breath and try to hold our mind to relating to that. I think after many, many years, that became clear with some instruction that we should be not doing that as a conceptual idea, not as a thinking of it as some kind of order or instruction, but to think of it more as relating with your feeling. Mm. Because the feeling of the body breathing is always happening now, right? Mm-hmm. You're not feeling something in the future, feeling something in the past. And so that feeling helps embody the mindfulness of breathing. Mm. And so I think it gives you a better hook, another hook into experiencing the breath and giving you something to connect with. Otherwise, it can tend to get a little bit hazy.
Uh-huh.
You don't know what that is. So the feeling of it is really visceral, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a great way to practice meditation. So I practice with that. I learned just at a meditation center, the Shivala Center in Milwaukee. And then I went on to do longer retreats, culminating in a month-long retreat, which was 30 days of meditation with one day off in the middle and doing about 14 hours of meditation a day. So we did this a lot, over and over and over and over. You may have had some experience of that with weekend trainings as well. So that was my experience in learning to meditate. It was a really challenging process. As you said, I've been doing this decades, and it's still challenging. We always say meditation is simple, but it's not easy. That's how I learned it. And that's how I continue to practice. I still am working every day with the thoughts and distractions that are in my mind, but you learn attitude with meditation, I think, and with mindfulness. And then later on, I learned to teach this to children, as you said, and a very different approach with the children, but it has the same fundamentals.
Mm. And could you talk a little bit about your public school experience?
Yes. I started off as a music teacher, and because I was a professional musician, as you read in the bio. And I realized I was teaching music, but I was also, I could only teach music if I had their attention. And that I realized that is like half the deal, more than half the deal. If that wasn't happening, you can't teach anything.
Right.
So, you know, teachers have all kinds of techniques they use in the classroom to manage classroom activities. And in music, I saw, wow, this is like, I can't teach if there's too much chaos going on in the room.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So I thought about that a lot, and I started using some of the techniques that I had learned in meditation, just not teaching them meditation at all, not teaching mindfulness at all at that time, but just doing things where I realized, I need to gather their attention. That's the deal. And so I relied on these teachings I had experience with, and it was very helpful. But then The thing I think you're pointing to is that after I retired from teaching music, I started teaching mindfulness through a couple of foundations in Milwaukee, teaching it to children. And there was some very wonderful curriculum that was out there that taught these practices. And for kids, unlike us as adults, where we might be able to sit still for a while and work with this, there had to be some bodily component. That's how you get mindfulness happening with kids. There's something they can do. And it makes things much easier for them to get engaged.
Oh, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And you said there was a curriculum. I did not know that. So this is in the Milwaukee Public School System?
No, the Milwaukee Public Schools hired a couple of groups I worked with, Growing Minds and Reset Mind Bodies, are two different groups. And they each had a curriculum, and we were all trained in the curriculum. We have visual supports, auditory supports. And so this curriculum is put together by these groups based on things that are probably were used, you know, all over the country at this time, because it was a building, you know, burgeoning tradition that was happening in a lot of places. Just as an example, like to get into meditation posture, if we're going to do that, we, you know, we sit upright with upright dignified posture, and we basically still our body, and then we might go to that object of meditation, which might be the breath. So with kids, we had a rhyme. So it was one hand, two hand, put them on your lap, sitting like a mountain with a long, strong back. And we would have the kids recite that with us. They learned it very quickly, of course, it's very simple. And they would be doing with their hands, like each hand coming out, one hand, two hand, put them in your lap. Just them being engaged with that brought them into sitting still. And that may be just for like a few seconds, that may be for a long time. But that physical connection, the physical activity is what would guide them in. And then there are a couple other practices. I'll just give two other examples.
Please, this is very interesting. Yeah.
That's cool. Something called flower hands. So we get kids in that posture, one hand, two hand, and then they would have their hands in front of them like little closed flowers. And then they open the hands flat open, like as if it was blooming. So it was, you'd inhale as the hands opened up and exhale as the hands closed. So inhale again, hands open. Exhale.
Beautiful. I love it.
Yeah. And that's tactile, right? Feel that. And that's how you could guide them in. If we told them, just sit down, inhale, exhale, follow your arm, that would not work very well, right? But this is one thing that really worked. And, something called take five, where you're counting on your fingers, an inhalation of five counts. As you tap each finger, and you can tap them back or run your fingers finger around your other fingers. These physical things are the way that got children to where you want them to be. We also use, by the way, one of our prime things is using a chime. So like you would ring a chime. Actually, I have one right here. I don't know how that will sound on your microphone.
Try it.
It's always weird. It might just go clack. We would, you know, we get them in their posture, one hand, two hand, and then ring the chime, and they would just listen. Nothing but listen. That was their activity. And when they could no longer hear it, have them raise their hand. The sound was gone.
Yes.
So this is what, you know, you have to have a little entertainment.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. And these were, I found them to be really workable. And, you know, you could use these with adults. And it would be
I was going to say. I think I had a communication student who had some kind of anxiety issues, and she had learned some kinds of anxiety reduction and focusing of attention that were similar to the practices you just described. And she taught them to us in class one day. It was wonderful. So I can see how this would be very helpful to school children.
Yeah, and you know, and as I examined that, and teachers would watch us, they'd be in the class as we did mm-hmm. it. They could work with these techniques with the children throughout the week. Then mm-hmm. a week later, they might add something new.
Mm.
And it was real. I found it really interesting that it's kind of a graduated approach that you do this thing with your poem or with your hands, but you're getting them to what you need them to get to. And
yes.
So it's a gradual approach. And so I think that this is a great way to teach kids, because kids, I don't know, maybe I'm guessing into one of your next questions, like, why would this be helpful, you know?
Yeah. I was also thinking, I don't want to get too much into the culture wars, but there's been some pushback, maybe you've heard about it, against so-called social emotional learning as a gateway to, some of the complaints I've heard is it's a waste of time in the classroom. It's a way for teachers to teach anything but the content of history, for example, and also to confuse students about their identity and to begin talking about critical race theory. And it really takes off, I mean, in terms of a narrative. And I'm just wondering if you, I don't want to put it all on you, Alan, but how would you respond to something like that? Or do we respond to something like that?
Well, the culture war is pretty strong, and we rarely change anyone's mind,
mm-hmm.
as I think mm-hmm. we all know. so in terms of those categories, like, you know, SEL and the rest, that's kind of a long lecture. You know, it's a long talk, yeah. long conversation, and people only want sound bites. So I don't know how I would respond to that, because, but kind of the same thing I said before, is that if they're not paying attention, they're not going to learn those historical facts.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the pressures exerted upon kids in terms of the distraction of all our little devices and everything, we are wired and trained into distraction. And mm-hmm. so to understand those things, like to understand your social emotional learning, for instance, is like, what a gift, mm-hmm. you know. We never, like, this is part of psychology, right? And mm-hmm. so there's, in the past, you know, way back when, there wasn't psychology. There was the church, right? And that just that told you what happened and how everything happens. And then science developed, and then they're the scientific specialists in psychology, which would be mm-hmm. psychiatrists, psychologists. Meditation is saying, you can actually check this out for yourself and not be confused. Mm-hmm. And so giving a student those tools is amazing. I think at this point, with the kind of distraction that and media stuff that's going on for kids, this is as essential as teaching kids how to use, not even fork or chopsticks mm-hmm. or whatever you use. Like, this is an essential living skill. And so good. I mean, to understand, let me back up. Like I said, in meditation, awareness is the learning the discoveries of mindfulness practice. One of those discoveries is emotions.
Mm.
Like, to understand what comprises your emotions, what are the things that trigger you? How do you actually help regulate yourself? Like these breathing exercises, like mm-hmm. I've seen this happen. I've seen in the hallway of a school, a child melting down, and a teacher who was in with part of this training in their school, taking them aside, having them breathe, that simple practice of breathing. We know mm-hmm. through science now that all kinds of things happen with the hormones and all the chemicals in the brain mm-hmm. to bring down the level of anxiety. So that, and then that's connected to, right, emotions, like mm-hmm. who I am, should I just care about me? What is compassion? So mindfulness is like a step into an exploration and understanding of oneself. And that's, I think we deserve it.
Yeah, to me, it's also essential. Quick story, when I discovered mindfulness when I was 17 years old. And I remember that because I was in my room obsessing over all my problems, freaking out. And some program came on, infomercial came on the radio, and it was How Your Mind Can Keep You Well by Dr. Roy Masters. And I'm not promoting him as a teacher, but I'm just saying that at that moment, it was something I needed to hear. And he just led the listener through a brief meditation, very basic, embodied meditation exercise. Had to do with feeling, being aware of your hand and the blood running through your fingers and that kind of thing. And it clicked for me at that moment. I don't know whether I put it in these words, but this is how I look back on it, that I was not my thoughts. There was a state of being that was separate from the stories that I was telling myself. So that was where the door opened for me, I think.
Yeah, that's huge. You know, like even when we're teaching children, we go through these exercises that I just mentioned to get it in the body. And then you start building into understanding thoughts and what your feelings are. So all that's going on, and it's not just kind of some kind of wishy-washy, what are my feelings? It's actually recognizing and being able to say, I'm angry. Just to know that is what a gift, because you can, to know that means that you can, you know where the disturbance is happening and what's going on, and you can accept it, not trying to push it away, which just causes extra problems, as we all know.
So it's like having your anger instead of your anger having you, that you have a layer of awareness that's larger than the anger itself.
Yeah. It's not, what is it? Brené Brown's, one of her books, her daughter's talking and saying that she realized that when she was at school and her teacher said she was bad, that she wasn't bad, that she did something bad.
Nice. Not identifying with it, right? That's a key. Yeah. By the way, this is WGTD, Education Matters. I'm Jonathan Shaler, your host. And right now I'm interviewing Alan Anderson, who is the author of When Bad Lands. And he is a meditation teacher, telling us about his experience as a teacher and a student of meditation. So thank you, Alan. And speaking of When Bad Lands, is this the book that people should read if they want to learn about meditation?
Could
you tell us a little bit about it?
There are so many books about meditation.
Okay.
I have a specific target audience, though, for this book. With all this talk of mindfulness and meditation in the airwaves, we may think that either it's useless or maybe we think it'll solve everything. And I went through a big difficult fall in my life, and I was a long time meditator, and I thought I could solve it with my meditation, but that was not true. And talk about social emotional learning. It's like, meditation manuals are not about social emotional learning, and it's an essential aspect of understanding ourselves. It's like not everything is given to us from the cultures of Hinduism and Buddhism and all that in the East. There's a lot of wonderful, tremendous understanding. So I found that I didn't have that emotional understanding of myself, and I went into a deep dive and to bring myself back to feeling sane and whole again, I did certain things and ended up being, I just in counting them, there were 7 things that I did and I wrote them down. So When Bad Lands is a whole front part of the book, which is talking kind of a basis of my story, what I went through, and then talking about kind of what are the basic pillars of this mindfulness meditation practice and the whole tradition of wisdom and all that from my tradition. So that's the front part of the book. And then the back part of the book are the 7 things that I ended up doing. Just not that I worked them out ahead of time, and not that I need to do some things to help myself. These are just the things I ended up doing. And so I had these 7 different aspects of what.
Could you tell us what they are?
Yeah, I could. So I call them the seven skills. And one is talking about the comment you just made, Jonathan, about you are not your thoughts. The first one is called not believing everything you think. So in my difficulties that I had on not believing everything you think, I kept telling myself, like, I messed up, I screwed up, I effed up, I did everything wrong, and I've really messed up this part of my life, and these stories going on and on and on. And one thing I learned in meditation was not believing everything you think, that that we try to grasp on in any way we can. Something. I'm really great or I'm really bad. We hold on to something. That's what our mind does. So about that, not believing the endless parade of words and sentences you tell about what's going on. Second one was not pretending things are otherwise. And that not pretending things are otherwise means that you can't pretend you're out of this difficulty and this confusion. Mm. You can't pretend that you're a terrible person and that this defines you.
Mm.
This is one of the things we learn in mindfulness meditation practice, is that we define ourselves, and we're telling ourselves over and over who Jonathan is and who Alan is, and like, you know, and why we should feel this way and why the other person is wrong and why we're wrong. You know, things like that.
So self-focused too.
Yeah. So not pretending things are otherwise is realizing that we're not, may not be as bad as we think we are, may not be as awesome as we think we are, but we are who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Pay attention to that. The third one is the meditation part itself, which is the mirror of meditation. So I give instructions, some small instruction there on meditation, but I didn't do much in the books. I feel like it's difficult to give instructions on the printed page. And so I've given people options. They can go to my webpage, alankendanderson.com, get some videos there as to how to be led through meditation. So that third part there was the action part of my seven skills. The first two parts is kind of like an understanding of mind. We call it view in our tradition, V-I-E-W, view. Not believing everything you think and not pretending things are otherwise. So now we're doing something.
I just want to interject briefly. You have some really helpful videos on teaching meditation, and I recommend them. You say they're on your website?
Yeah, they are. Yes, alankentanderson.com. There's a number.
Alankentanderson.com. Yeah, one that really worked for me was not meditating, you called it. Let's sit down and not meditate. You tricked me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, as a matter of fact, and that's one of the things in the chapter on meditation. I do talk through that process called Don't Meditate. And there's also, by the way, there's a audio version of this book where you can hear me talk through
it. Oh, great.
Yeah. So that's, anyhow, that's doing something. That's the meditation practice. But another thing to do is something I call filling yourself with wisdom and reminders. That when we are filling our mind with those thoughts that we've been talking about, identifying with them, that there's a lot of brilliant wisdom in the world. And filling, having, like, changing the channel is really helpful when we're telling ourselves how we've messed up or you know, what a total, you know, problem we are. Like, to have other things to remind us otherwise. And there's so many great things, so I suggest people find the things in your tradition. What doesn't matter what it is, you know, Christian, Buddhist, Islam, whatever makes you connect to something that's kind of bigger and a broader perspective, which has a, which is signified by wisdom. So that's really helpful. And I mentioned that there are, in the Tibetan tradition, for instance, at a monastery, there are the six sessions people do to remind themselves to be mindful all day. Six different points during the day. So it's like meditation for when you wake up and for these 4 hours. And then if you need to meditate again after 4 hours, because you're going to forget. That's how fast we lose it, right? That's how fast we jump right back to our iPhones and our...
One of on that, in terms of, if I don't remember, the sixth literally is every time I go through a transition, like from eating breakfast to my next activity, use that as a moment.
Yeah.
Anyway.
If someone uses breath, they could say to themselves, breathe. As simple as that, take a breath or feel your feet, you know, feet being far up, the farthest thing from your head that's doing all this busy work, right?
Mm.
So there's lots of little things you can do just to remind yourself. So that was number four. And the fifth one was called, this is fear practice. And that's something I just did to acknowledge times where I was feeling really angry. This could be called, this is anger practice. This is my heartbreaking practice. And all these go under the category of that we know familiarly as a name it to tame it, that we give it a name, just like that child in Brené Brown's book saying, I'm not bad, I did something bad.
Mm-hmm.
We can actually give a name to this, and that can be very helpful in just settling us out, because we want to push that away or stomp it down. And so just to accept, to be there with it.
Mm.
And then there's two more. The second last one is the genuine heart of sadness, to recognize that there's a poignancy that's part of our natural human condition. It's called sadness here, but it's called a genuine heart of sadness, like the heartfelt quality you might feel when you hear some amazing music or feel something expressed as love towards you, or watch it go on, you know, between your children on the playground or something. Mm-hmm. That tender thing is a part of our human heritage, and it's the most beautiful things. But we try to tamp that down. You know, we don't want to feel tough and all that. So it's just to treasure that and to acknowledge this genuine heart of sadness. And then the final one is a little esoteric. It's called the four-way mirror. It just comes from a Tibetan depiction of this deity that holds a mirror at its heart. And it's a four-way mirror that you can see through, and it also reflects. And I just use this as an analogy to how we might be able to be better with each other.
Mm.
Not pretend, you know, we see this in politics endlessly, right? Just lies, outward lies, and and just trying to fool people and gaslight them. So the idea that I can see you clearly and you can see you clearly, you have the mirror, I'm looking through your mirror, and you can see me clearly, and I can see, like, if we had that kind of honest clarity, that would be just something maybe to aspire to. I may not see it in this lifetime as a societal movement, but I thought it was a good model.
That's something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I would just say, personally, I've read your book and I've listened to your audiobook while running, and I love both versions, and I think it's personally been very helpful to me. So I would recommend it. But in terms of other books, I'm a book person. Do you have any others that you might recommend to people who are wanting to get in on the ground floor, or like what you're saying now and would like to learn more?
Yeah. I like to often recommend Pema Chodron.
Mm-hmm.
All of her books are just, they capture something very alive and real and gentle. And so she can give instructions in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Chogyam Trungpa is my, I'll spell it, Chogyam Trungpa, Trungpa, was my original main Buddhist teacher, where I started learning meditation.
Mm.
His books are also, there's just so many of them, and they're really interesting. But what I would like to say is that, yeah, I'm a book person too. I got tons of books. I'm finding what I can see online is being really helpful.
Are you seeing good stuff there?
Yeah. Yeah. There are some people who are just wonderful teachers. Susan Piver.
Okay.
She has a couple of books out. She used to study in the same tradition I did and fell away, and has the largest online community of meditators in the world. Yeah. And it's run by women, and men and women both attend. Lots of women.
Wow. That's awesome.
Her, her teaching is brilliant and just like really earthy. And she does, on her website, you'll see her giving instruction in multiple ways. And she does it the same way I would do it. And so
okay.
I like that. Just having that direct access to her. There's a Zen teacher named Sokuzan who studied originally in the same tradition I was with, but he's a Zen teacher.
Yes.
And he combines Zen and this Tibetan mindfulness awareness practice, and he is utterly brilliant.
I love his presence. He's an ex-Marine, and he has this very hearty presence. Yeah. I love him. Yeah.
So I've been finding those to be helpful. Mm-hmm. So I think that maybe, Jonathan, that there's a sense of the way to kind of practice and be with a live or even on Zoom presence is really, really helpful and heartfelt. Mm-hmm. But I think going to the books is like the where you start learning that second part of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, mindfulness, awareness, the discoveries of meditation. Galen Ferguson is another wonderful teacher that I've studied with. I love
Galen Ferguson.
Mm-hmm. Galen Ferguson, yeah. So many of these people have talked for such a long time, and they're Western culture. And so they talk to us in the way we, it's really helpful for us to be talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many great teachers all over, and I've been exposed to them due to this time of COVID, right? Mm-hmm. I explored more and saw, wow, there's amazing stuff going on out there.
And you started something during COVID, a Facebook. Did it start on Facebook?
Yes, yes.
A gathering, a teaching practice. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, when COVID happened, people were all pretty freaked out. What's going on? Everything shut down. All of a sudden, I can't go out. There's a lot of fear, particularly in the beginning. And so I thought it would be helpful to give people a mindfulness practice, very simple and really mindful of practice. It wasn't like a mindfulness awareness practice. It was like simply sitting there with your body, mindful of the body breathing, very embodied practice also. But I did that actually twice a day, every single day for almost a year.
Wow.
Of COVID, the beginning of COVID. And then I started changing that, and I got to like one time a day, but still 7 days a week. And I moved it to 5 days a week, just the weekdays, and then to 3 days a week. Now it's a summertime and people are outside and they deserve to be outside. What we've gone through. And so there's a little less attendance now, but I still do it two mornings, 9 a.m. in the morning. It's on Zoom and it's also on Facebook.
Okay. If somebody was interested in checking that out, what should they do?
Look up Milwaukee Shambhala Center online, and all the links are there.
Okay.
Or if you're a Facebook person, and if you're you can friend me, and then you can just see it live on Facebook. When someone's doing something live on Facebook, it tells you, oh, this person's live, and you could watch that at that time. But it's probably much easier to just jump into the Milwaukee Shambhala Center website where all the things are listed.
And if I was a teacher listening to this broadcast and I was thinking, I haven't really taught anything like meditation in my classroom, but now I'm intrigued. I think I might try a little bit of that, even for myself. I want to bring it into my classroom. Do you have any recommendation of where to look or where to begin thinking about that?
Well, first of all, it's not going to be helpful to teach something you don't do already.
Yeah.
I think it's a tendency in America, right? You read something and all of a sudden you start a web page and you're charging.
Oh, gosh.
So, by the way, I'm sorry, before I forget this, there's a book called Smile at Fear.
Smile at Fear.
I'm Togyam Trungpa, I mentioned before. It's it's just one of my favorite books for understanding meditation and how we deal with our challenges and difficulties.
Okay.
But anyhow.
Thank you. Yeah. Since I brought that up, I'll mention a couple of books. I don't know if you've Please. Come across them, but I feel obligated now that I've raised the issue. So I'm in higher ed. So there's actually a big movement in higher education. And the book, the go-to book that I would recommend is titled Contemplative Practices in Higher Education. And it's edited by Daniel Barbazet and Mirabai Bush. And then for all of the rest of us, for every teacher, Mindful Teaching and Teaching Mindfulness by Deborah Schoeberling. And it's a very good book, recommended by Daniel Goleman and others. So, yeah. But I think this is a good thing.
You're on top of that. Like I haven't done any of this teaching since prior to COVID, because all these teaching opportunities in the public schools just disappeared overnight. So they haven't really quite restored it yet. Hopefully that'll be happening more.
Oh yeah, right.
But yeah, so I'm not really tuned into what's going on now. So thank you for that. Because yes, sure. With the proviso that one has to experience that themselves, so they're actually a decent instructor in doing it. That's important. But having these sources, I know it's out there. A lot of people are taking it very seriously, and they know the value of it despite the interference from the culture wars.
Yeah. I once heard, I think there's something a little bit to this anyway, you best teach what you most need to learn yourself.
Yeah.
There's something about that. You know.
Yeah.
So, Alan, we have about a minute. And I just wondered if there's anything on your mind or that you'd like to share, anything about what's your cutting edge right now or anything.
Yeah, I'm trying right now, putting a lot of my effort in, not into education, but into understanding all the ways our culture suffers.
Hmm.
So I'm looking a lot at teachers like Angel Kyodo Williams, who is a Black meditation teacher, and she like what she brings in terms of our race relationships and racial justice is really helpful when you bring this into meditation context. Because you know what spirituality is, what meditation, mindfulness is finding out what's true. That's really what we're doing. We're finding out what's real and what's true instead of our stories, our exaggerations, the tales we tell ourselves. And so part of that really connects to how we've been as a society, whether it has to do with racial justice, with gender issues, to find out what's real and not just get spun out due to emotional extremes and stuff. That's helpful. So I feel like so much about this mindfulness practice is not this navel gazing, quote unquote, but it's about connecting with what appears to be real. And I'm actually starting to write another book, and that book is about, really has to do with knowing, seeing what's true, because we're just so taken away from that so much, particularly in politics, which is just a reflection of how we do that in our interpersonal relationships as well.
Wow. So,
I feel like
I want to read that book. When is it coming out?
Slow going.
Okay. Well, it's exciting to know that you're working on it. And
thank you.
I want to thank you so much, Alan, for this wonderful conversation. I could talk to you for hours, but this is a great start. And I hope that our listeners enjoyed it as well, as much as I did. So this was Alan Anderson, meditation teacher and musician and person extraordinaire. And I'm Jonathan Shaler, your host for Education Matters. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been wonderful.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org. Support comes from Pet Supplies Plus, now open in Kenosha at 3755 80th Street. Pet Supplies Plus is everything you need to keep your pets happy, healthy, and thriving, including all of your favorite brands, plus the best local ones, online at PetSuppliesPlus.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services fundraiser, Bowls and Bakers, is coming up Wednesday, November 8th at Parkway Chateau from 11 to 1:30 p.m. All the soup you want, plus a bake sale.